Welcome to the Brave Feminine Leadership Podcast, where I get to dig into delicious conversations with global leaders and academics, and we get to soak up their wisdom on life and leadership. And today I could not be more excited to introduce Anna Brooke to everyone. Anna, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Now, let me touch briefly on your bio. So Dr. Anna Brooke is a social scientist, and while in business school, she fell in love with social psychology. So now she conducts research in her favourite field at the University of Mannheim, Germany. Her research focuses on showing vulnerability and self-compassion, and the results of her work have been published in top scientific journals and are featured in global outlets such as The Atlantic and Scientific American. Now, Anna, I first came across you in Scientific American, where I read your article all about the beautiful mess effect. And I've tracked you down across the globe. We've coordinated our diaries so that I think for me it's 6 o'clock in the morning. What time is it for you in Germany?
It's 8:20 p.m.
Excellent. So we've managed to tame these global time zones, and here we are together having what I'm sure will be a fabulous conversation. So, Anna, once again, welcome. And can I just ask you for our audience just to share, who are you as a human being and how did you end up doing the important work that you're doing?
Yeah, so now I am a social psychologist and my world revolves around topics such as human connection and personal growth. So it seems quite natural now that when I was a teenager and when I asked myself, what do I want to study? The first thing that came to mind was psychology. And yet I didn't go for it. The problem was that I didn't realize that you could do so many different things with a psychology degree. I thought if you study psychology, you have to be a therapist. And since I'm someone who can take on other people's emotions quite easily, I thought that wouldn't be a good fit for me. And I had no idea that you can either learn emotional boundaries and still be a therapist, or you can do so many other interesting things with a psychology degree. So I ended up in business school instead. But during my master's degree, I had a chance to minor in psychology. And during my first lecture, which happened to be social psychology, I just completely fell in love with the subject. The way that you fall in love with people. It was just really amazing. I can still remember that sense of, I could have studied that all along.
I've been studying business.
Exactly. I've been kind of dancing around the topic, doing marketing and stuff, but that was where, you know, the real treasure was. Because I was so fascinated by that main premise of social psychology, that people are not good or bad. They are very much in the gray area, you know? And it's the context, the situation we find ourselves in that brings out the positive, the negative sides of us. And all this gray area is basically where human nature lives, right? So I started to get a sense that I was starting to understand how humans work, you know, what makes us tick, why we feel the way we feel, why we act the way we act. And I remember sitting there in that very first lecture and telling my friend, let's study psychology when we retire. Because in Germany, there's this really cool thing that when you're retired, you can just sign up for any classes that you want and just learn, you know, do the same.
I love that.
It's really amazing. So that was my first thought, you know, okay, let's do that. But then, of course, I couldn't wait that long. So I ended up doing a PhD in social psychology, actually with the professor who held that first lecture.
Okay. And you had a period of illness that you shared with me that impacted on you. When was that? How did that all factor into this?
That was 11 years ago. There was this period where I was recovering from an operation and I could not do much. I was stuck at home, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I ended up watching to a lot of TED Talks. And one of them was by Kristen Neff on self-compassion. And the other one, the other important one on the list was by Brené Brown on vulnerability. And accidentally, those two TED Talks combined kind of changed my life.
People do say TED Talks change their lives, but they literally changed your life. So,
Definitely, yes.
had you already made the move to studying psychology by this point? So, were you,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes, it was actually, I was still working as a student assistant, and the researcher who I was working for, she sent me the self-compassion TED Talk while I was stuck at home, kind of like, oh, I bet you could use it. And little did she know how much I could use it. Not just because of that particular point in time, but in general.
Fantastic. That is so fantastic. So let's tell us, share with the audience, because I'm just fascinated by this. Where did those two TED Talks by Kristen Neff and Brené Brown, where did they take you? What did they lead you to explore?
So it wasn't just the TED Talk, obviously, because 20 minutes is not quite that much. But I did read both of the books right away. The first one was the self-compassion one, and what it did is it kind of, a light went on when I read it, because it, like, now when I talk about it, it sounds ridiculous to say that I had no clue that you can be kind to yourself. But 11 years ago, self-compassion wasn't that big thing that everybody knew about. It was just starting to get out there. And I actually really, I just didn't know. I thought that this type of self-critical self-talk, this is how you get stuff done. This is just
I've got
how
to
it
fire my
is.
yeah, I've got to fire myself up to be better, to do more, to work
Exactly,
harder.
exactly, exactly. And I mean, that book did really a lot of things for me, but I guess the underlying theme is that I learned that you can get much further and you will have much more fun along the way if you motivate yourself through love and not through fear, the way self-criticism does. And that was really a revolution that just affected every area of my life.
We might circle back around to that because there's a particular distinction she makes between self-esteem and self-compassion, but we'll come back.
Yes.
So let's stay on your, let's stay on this theme of what you were uncovering and what came from that.
Yeah, and then also, with the self-compassion book, till this day, it remains the only book that I read twice in a row. I read it from cover to cover, and then I thought, oh my God, I really need to get that into my head, or deeper than that, into my heart, like into my bones, because I really need to live this and not just to know this as a theory. And so I went back right away and read it again, and then started doing all the meditations and writing exercises that Kristen Neff recommended. And that's where the gold was, practicing it every day.
And that's so important when you say that, because I think for us to absorb anything, we have to do it. It's no good just reading it, is it?
Exactly. It's usually the books where I really started doing things afterwards that actually had a change and not, led to a change in my life and not just to some interesting insights that you forget a few months later.
Absolutely. And so Renee was part of this journey as well.
So the second book right after that was Daring Greatly, which conveniently fit very well into everything I had just learned. And from that book, what I took away was that this one skill, the ability to be vulnerable, is somehow at the center of everything we want in life. It just unlocks everything, from fulfilling relationships to an interesting, fulfilling career, a juicy creative life, resilience, everything that we need to have a good, meaningful life is somehow not really possible if you cannot make peace with vulnerability. And so that left a sense of, you know what, this is something really worth spending time on, both for me personally and later in research, because I felt like, if I'm gonna spend the next 3, 4 years with one topic, it's gotta be something where I feel like this is really gonna make a difference. Well, it's 11 years later, and I'm still discovering more and more to research about it. And I'm very glad that I went with something that felt like it really does make a difference across the board.
So what did you find? Share with us, some of the findings. And vulnerability is scary for people. So yeah, so tell us what you found, and let's dig into that question about how can we actually feel safe about being vulnerable as well.
So, one piece of good news that we found is that while we see our own displays of vulnerability in a quite negative light, others see it way more positively. Where we see weakness, others see strength. Where we see inadequacy, others see courage. And so we are not the best judge of, what's happening when we are caught in a vulnerable situation. And we call these differences in perception the beautiful mess effect because it just incorporates both of these perspectives, the messiness we feel when we are caught up in feeling vulnerable and the beauty that others see when we take the chance and to show our vulnerability.
Absolutely fantastic. So what did you, how did you arrive at the article? So give us more. Let's dig right into what experiments you did and all sorts of different things. How did you work this out?
So we ran a bunch of experiments, seven in the first paper, and what we did is that we asked participants to imagine themselves in very different vulnerable situations, and we asked the other half of the participants to imagine someone else in the very same vulnerable situation. So the situations were, for instance, confessing love first, or admitting that you've made a mistake, or asking for help, or revealing imperfections. So very different types of situations. And across all of them, we saw the same pattern that when we asked the participants to evaluate this act of showing vulnerability, either from their own perspective or from the perspective of another person, consistently, they all evaluated showing vulnerability more positively for others than oneself.
So let's talk us through what were the key insights out of Brené Brown's work that really jumped out at you and factored into this research? Because I know everyone in the audience loves Brené Brown.
Yes. Well, actually, the starting point, these differences in perception, that was the paradox that she described in Daring Greatly. So all of this research in the beginning was completely based on her observations. And she actually wrote in Daring Greatly at the end that all of her qualitative research, all of her theories at some point will be tested by quantitative research. And I felt like I just had to sign up for the job. So that's where we started. And we tested whether there is indeed this paradox of differences in perception, and then we built on that.
Did you find any gender differences or any notable differences at all through the study?
Interestingly, no. I've had quite a lot of discussions on this topic because intuitively we would think that there would be gender differences. But no, very consistently, it's both men and women who have these differences in perception.
So we all find ourselves, all is a very, loose term, I guess, but we all find ourselves in situations where the fear of being vulnerable and potentially the self-talk about being vulnerable
Exactly.
is that it's going to be seen as a display of weakness, but your research is showing the opposite, that those vulnerable moments, people actually view them as courage.
Exactly. So there are sometimes some differences in terms of self-compassion that women tend to have somewhat less self-compassion than men, but still, the results that self-compassion helps to decrease these differences and to see our own vulnerabilities in a more positive light, that's still the same for men and women.
So it probably feels like a good point to pick up that difference, that Kristen Neff difference between self-esteem and self-compassion, so the audience are really clear on what do we mean when we're talking about it if they haven't seen
Right.
Kristen's work. So can you just outline for us what those differences are? And so when you use the term self-compassion, what are you really talking about?
So to begin with, let's define what self-compassion is, and it's basically a kind way of relating to yourself, and it has three main components. First, the self-kindness. It's treating yourself the way you would treat a good friend versus criticizing yourself. The second one is common humanity. This is keeping in mind that we're all in the same boat when it comes to imperfections and failure, and nobody has an easy life. Nobody goes through it without regretting something. And then the third component is mindfulness, where we can face these imperfections. We don't have to run away from them. But we also don't need to exaggerate their significance. We don't over-identify with them when we are in a mindful state. We don't think it's the end of the world. So this is self-compassion. And what it does is that it gives you a very, very stable way of relating to your own struggles. And the very interesting difference between self-compassion and self-esteem is that self-compassion is there for us when self-esteem fails us.
Okay, so and
So,
self-esteem is, how do we describe self-esteem?
yeah, self-esteem is basically having a positive self-view. But what happens if you make a mistake? This is exactly what challenges the positive self-view. And self-esteem is very dependent on the outcome. So if you did a good work, self-esteem would tell you you did a good job, you can be proud of yourself. But if it didn't go well, if you made a mistake or maybe it just things just didn't turn out, self-esteem is very, very dependent on that. So it has nothing to hold on to. So it fluctuates a lot and it can go quite significantly down, when you are experiencing any form of failure or just struggling. And this is exactly when we need self-compassion, when we are down, because self-compassion is not dependent on the outcome. It says, whatever happens, you have a safe place here, basically within yourself. Because whatever happens, your worth, it doesn't depend on the outcome of your work or whatever else that comes from the outside. So it's much more stable.
Let me take a brief pause from listening to the podcast for a minute just to check in and see if the conversation's inspiring any new thoughts or any new reflections for you. I hear so often from people in our audience, largely successful and senior professional women, how much they are craving some inspiration into their lives. I would just love to share with you, if you're looking for some, then come and sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. You can find a link in the show notes at the end of the show. Now let's get back to the podcast.
I love that. And I love, because when I listen to that, part of what I think with self-esteem is that you are comparing yourselves to a certain extent. Like you're looking around and comparing yourselves. And I know, I think Kristen said something about no one wants to think of themselves as average. So with
Exactly.
self-esteem, we're all looking around to how do I compare to that person? And I know a lot
Exactly.
of the women in our audience, very high achieving, ambitious professionals who've got wonderful careers, often when they hit rocky points, maybe they are looking around and they are thinking to themselves sometimes, why am I not as far ahead as that peer? Or why am I not, there's all these sort of comparison questions. But I really like with self-compassion that when you, there is a global outlook to it, but that global outlook is that, hang on a minute, everybody's going through these challenging things. So I think that's a really important definition here. How do people feel safe? Because we can feed them all this information, and logically, people can read your research and they can say, okay, I've got this big vulnerable moment coming up. I made a mistake, or I don't feel comfortable with this part of the work I'm doing. I don't know how to do it, and I'm just waiting for people to find out I don't know how to do it. How do we help people get to the point of actually feeling safe to be vulnerable?
Yeah, the difference between just reading about it and thinking, oh, that sounds nice, and actually living it is practice, the way we just talked about it. It's through regular practice that we can retrain our brains to think differently, because we've been practicing self-criticism for a very long time, decades. And luckily, we don't need decades to teach our brains new tricks, but it does take a little bit of regular practice so that the brain learns, oh, there's another way to live, and I actually enjoy that one much more. And so to feel safe, we need first to create that safe space within ourselves. Through self-compassion, we can do that through regular meditation or writing exercises. Kristen F. has wonderful meditation files and exercises on her website. If you just do them regularly for a few months, I promise you, your world will look very differently, first internally and then externally. And this is the foundation, because when we first find ourselves in a situation where we are just considering showing vulnerability, it's just so much harder to go through with this if you know that if something goes wrong, you will be tearing yourself, to pieces. And obviously, this is when perfectionism comes in, and this is the enemy of being vulnerable, of being authentic, of being true to yourself. to feel safe while being vulnerable. We need to know that even if it doesn't go well, I'll be okay, because my internal world is a safe place to be. And then the reactions of others won't have such a huge impact on us, because we are okay with ourselves. But I gotta say that others' reactions do matter.
Yes.
We are social beings, so we cannot be an island and try to constantly feel safe through more and more self-compassion while we are in an unhealthy environment. So the environment needs to have a certain level of safety too, psychological safety, either of the organization or the group of people or the one person that you are sharing vulnerably with. Because a self-compassionate person will not stay in an unhealthy environment for a prolonged period of time. They know they deserve more, right?
Okay. So, well, let's just sit there for a minute then. How do people know? So how do people assess if they're in a psychologically safe environment in the first place?
Right. So you just, you can ask yourselves a few questions. Is it safe to make a mistake, or will I be criticized and punished for it? Is it safe to voice an opinion that doesn't go with the majority or contradicts the one person I'm talking to? Is it safe to ask for help? Is it in general safe to communicate in terms of how respectful the conversation is? You know, will you be treated with respect, or is there shouting, belittling, and all of that stuff, which obviously doesn't make us feel safe? So overall, the underlying theme here is, especially in organizations, you know, are you being treated as a human being or as a human resource?
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's a really great question for people to ask. And I love the part where you said, so I'm going to take you back there, around self-compassionate individuals don't stay in mm-hmm. psychologically unsafe places for a long time.
Right.
So you tell me about that.
Well, the environment has an impact on you. And if you have a good level of self-compassion and someone treats you not in the way that goes along with it, because when the way you treat yourself is your comfort zone, so to speak, even if it's not very comfortable, but it's familiar and that makes it safe. And so if your basic level is pretty high when it comes to self-compassion, that means that your standard is of how others treat you will be more or less at the same level too. So if that does not occur, if you made a mistake and someone is really harsh with you, and you think to yourself, well, that's not how I talk to myself, that's not how I want to be treated, and as mindfulness is part of self-compassion, you can come up with a lot of reasons why in this particular situation that person might be so harsh. You know, they slept 2 hours, you know, they had a bad day, whatever. So it's not like a self-compassionate person will just get out of there the second something goes wrong, because the way they make space for their own mistakes, they will make space for other people's mistakes too. But everything has its limits. So if that happens consistently, and you see, you know what, this is not a bad day, this is not a bad night, this is just how this person is choosing to show up right now,
Yes.
or this is just the culture in this place, and this is bigger than me. Then at some point, a self-compassionate person will ask themselves, what am I doing here? And they will start looking for ways out.
This is so fascinating. You just made me think, when you talked before about someone is hypercritical of a mistake you've made, and and I would always have said through my whole career, and this was probably much more of a self-esteem place than a self-compassion, I would have always been harder on myself than they could ever be. And so, as you were saying that, that was me sitting there thinking, well, I don't think I had a very good level of self-compassion, in those younger days, because I would beat myself up for those mistakes that I made. I had resilience, so I could bounce back from it. But that self-compassion and the way you explained it then, I think was wonderful, because it also meant that you were not making up stories about the other person. You were actually sitting and creating space for the fact that maybe they've had a bad day. Maybe there's stuff going on for them. It's not all me.
Because the way you treat yourself is naturally going to be similar to how you treat others. And so if you have that mindful awareness around behavior with yourself, then especially you will have it with other people. The way you described it, most of us would never talk to other people the way we talk to ourselves. That's why I needed the self-compassion book twice.
Yes, that's the inside voice. We don't let that one out.
It's like we would not even talk that way to a person we truly like
No.
despise.
We save that for ourselves.
If you rebuild that relationship with yourself, then first you make space for mistakes of others, and you also understand that the environment impacts you, and you just don't let people treat you badly for a prolonged period of time if that's not some kind of a comfort zone for you, subconsciously, of course.
The thing I hear a lot is, sadly, there are lots of poor leaders, and leaders who potentially shouldn't necessarily be in leadership roles. And often I hear people who are very keen to, they don't know how to, but they're very keen to give feedback to their leader. I mean, that's a very vulnerable conversation to have. I don't know whether you've got anything in any of your information about that.
You mean how to give feedback?
Well,
Or
that's a really, I think people feel incredibly vulnerable in those moments, because I want to give feedback to someone who could fire me. They've got a job in my career. And so for a lot of people, I wonder, self-compassion or not, that feels like a difficult conversation to have. I don't know whether you've come across anything like that.
It is, of course, a very vulnerable conversation. And the thing is that this is when you find out how psychologically safe the environment is. Because for a leader to take in the feedback, the honest feedback that is not just shiny and pink and what have you, there needs to be certain self-awareness on their part. And the employees who are in that situation, they usually have a good sense of whether it's safe or not to give feedback. So in that specific situation, the people I would be addressing would be specifically the leaders. It's their job to create an environment which welcomes feedback. And a very, very good way to do that is to show others that you can take it. And you can do that by sharing previous experiences of receiving negative feedback. You can. There's been a very, very good study from Adam Grant's lab, which looked at this, and that what the researchers found out is that the best way to create that long-term psychological safety is not to just invite the feedback, but to actually share vulnerably how you received feedback in the past and what you learned from it, because this shows to your employees that you will be okay with that, that you are interested in growing, that you do want to learn from it, and they will not pay a price for it. So when you consistently show that you're okay with this, people will tell you what you need to hear. And this will make the whole environment so much better off for it. But I wouldn't go just to any random employee and say, just say your truth and so on, because that depends on what kind of environment you're in. Maybe it's not safe. And maybe that's a reason to think long and hard how long you want to stay in this
Absolutely.
in this situation. So
So 11 years down the track, after falling in love with this whole idea and this subject and uncovering the beautiful mess effect, which really feeds off of two important areas of research, what is firing you up today? What rabbit holes are you diving down and unable to get out of at this point in time?
right. So right now I'm looking at cultural differences, for instance, regarding this effect. So there's not much data yet to talk publicly about it, but it seems like it's going to be an interesting road to take. So stay tuned on
Well, stay tuned for that
that.
one.
Yeah, other than that, I'm currently working on developing a program, that would actually help people to feel safe in vulnerable situations at work and to distinguish between a place where, they can show up vulnerably, where it's safe to practice being more vulnerable or not, and how to create that safety from within your organization. Because I feel like by now, thanks to Brené, we've learned that vulnerability is a good thing. So right now, I feel like our biggest challenge is that to actually live it, and to actually implement it, to let go of the fears if that's appropriate for the situation, or learn to change the situation you're in.
Amazing. So we really do need to stay tuned and follow what you're up to, Annabelle. Fantastic. I'm so glad I tracked you down on the other side of the world.
Me
The
too.
final question that I ask of everybody is, what does brave feminine leadership mean to you, and do you think it needs to change?
Yeah, so when I think about brave leadership in general, I would say that means to me to show up authentically, to lead authentically. And brave feminine leadership then means to embrace the feminine aspects of us and just make space for them. Yeah, such things as emotional intelligence and cooperation versus competition and building relationships, building strong, meaningful relationships, creating psychological safety. But at the same time, it also means that without this orientation towards others, I think the bravest part for us is to learn how to not be with others at the expense of the relationship to self. So that means to say no when we have to set clear boundaries, and to be in touch with our own needs. That I feel is sometimes the bravest thing we can do right now as women.
Amazing, Dr. Anna Brooke. We're definitely going to follow closely with the work that you do. So thank you so much for the important work, and keep us tuned if you find any more TED Talks or books that you immediately want to read twice.
You'll be the first to know.
Fantastic. So lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for joining our conversation.
Thank you.
And that was the end of another podcast conversation. So thank you so much for listening to the episode today. I often hear from leaders who felt inspired by the conversations and are ready to put themselves first. And so I wanted to take a brief moment just to share how I've helped hundreds of women, just like you, become crystal clear on the exact steps they should be following right now to lead an intentional and sustainable life without second-guessing themselves so that they can maximize their influence and impact. I've put some details into the show notes, and there's a link there where you can find out some more about our signature Elevate and Influence program. While you're there, take the time to sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. Have a brilliant day.